Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime. LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
All right, you've come back into the House of Mystery, fool that you are, and I am the host, Al Warren, and Michael Hawley is joining me today to talk about Jack the Ripper.
Hi, Al, how you doing?
I am delicious.
So it's another one of my fields are of interest and expertise. So I love having interviewing in this particular area.
Yeah, another Paul. This one's Paul Williams. So what can you tell us about Paul Williams?
Well, Paul's been around a while. He's kind of done something that is kind of interesting, that he's focused on the suspects, not just a couple or just one particular one. He's taking the wide view and looking at that, and then just kind of giving the reader a snapshot of all the suspects. And I think it's well over 300 now that he has, and growing. So,
well, I mean, you know, I still say it's real. How can you have so many suspects? The truth is, you know, so these people were killed savagely and all that. How can you actually have 500 suspects?
Well, Scotland Yard did not have that many. It was Scotland Yard only had a handful. So what happens through time is there were so many maniacs back then. Someone says, ooh, I like this particular person. He was, you know, means, motive, and opportunity. He was there. He was an evil person. He probably used the knives. And so the next thing you know, he becomes a suspect. So some of these suspects are not contemporary suspects from Jack the Ripper, or I mean from Scotland Yard, but for other reasons. And so, and it looks like Paul is taking from every one of them. And so, but when I was reading his book, he does a pretty good job, a really good job actually at focusing on like the top 10 and then going into all the others. So it's kind of like one of the things I like to talk about is the fallacy of false equivalency, where when someone says, how about, why would you say your suspect is greater, is as good as any of the others? But then again, you got to look at the devil's in the details, and you got to look at the specifics. And so you see that some suspects were taken more seriously than others. And so I think Paul did a great job at that.
I think it's making things overly complicated, having that many suspects.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what to say. but it was a big city, and murders were going on. And but, you know, there's got to have been a lot of evil, bad people in the city, especially in that side of the city where a lot of crime and prostitution and all that was pretty rampant.
Yes, and especially in the East End. There were murders at the time. It was a rough area. But these were different. These were not murders for, let's say, a domestic dispute or murder for some kind of, let's say, theft of someone. Let's say someone was walking through the East End dressed to the hilt with gold sticking out of his pockets. Well, he deserves to be attacked. but it was these particular women were murdered almost for the sake of murder. So it was a strange and different thing. But there was a Melville McNaughton who was in charge of the Whitechapel murders in 1889, a little bit after. He made a comment that when 1 year later someone was convinced of a particular suspect, he wanted to clarify it that, listen, there were a lot of maniacs, monomaniacs they would call them at the time, so, but there was only one murderer, so... They had a lot of work to do, but
yeah, that would have been great if they would have had DNA back then, or even took fingerprints.
Oh, and I'm convinced if they did, he would have been caught that fast.
Yeah.
So,
but different time back then. It was before coronavirus.
Yeah. True. 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 Are you sweating at all, by the way? Do you have any symptoms yourself?
Oh, yeah, I have them all the time. And actually, I head out and I get around as many people as possible.
Okay, because you're closer to the area than I am in Buffalo. Although New York State on the eastern part has had some.
Oh, you're going to all be wiped out. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
It's all going to be. It's a dirty area.
Yeah.
Well, no, I am quarantining myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm stuck.
Yeah.
Me and my dogs. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. Staying away from crowds. No, well, I stay away from crowds anyway because I don't like them.
You know, married myself as an Irish-German marrying into an Italian family, when I heard that Italy had kind of an exceptionally high percentage, I get that because I personally had to get used to hugging and kissing, and I'm not used to that at all. And it's part of that culture of my wife's family, which is great. I mean, there's so much bond, but the communicable diseases can be passed on pretty fast, I would say.
They're proven that over this. My God, country is closed.
Well, I mean, even in our culture, when you sing happy birthday, what do? You spit on the cake when you're blowing out the candles.
Yeah, well, you know, no one ever gives me a birthday cake. So.
Happy birthday.
Yeah,
sometime.
Nobody likes me. Yeah, nobody likes me. Well, we will go for just a quick break, and then we'll get Paul Williams on the phone, and he's in Australia, so he's calling from there, so that'll be interesting.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to legacyfoodstorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and co-hosting today is Michael the Ripper Holly.
That's right.
So now today we are talking Jack the Ripper, and with that we're talking to an author that has written a book called Jack the Ripper Suspects, The Definitive Guide and Encyclopedia. It's part of the True Crime, Murder, and Mayhem series. It's under the R.J. Parker Publishing. Okay, so we have Paul Williams. Thank you for being here, Paul.
Thank you for inviting me. Delighted to be here.
So now, Paul, let's start out. How did you get involved with Jack the Ripper? Like, what drew you to it enough that you are writing a book about it?
Well, it started a long time ago. When I was a teenager back in the 1980s, I would borrow books from a local library in Birmingham, a place called Erdington, and I would read about the Royal Conspiracy and various other theories at the time. Then when I went to university, I was studying history, and I happened to see a copy of Philip Soutland's book in the local branch of W.H. Smith, and I bought that, and I read it several times, and I thought, this is how history should be. It's a factual account, it's very, very readable, it's to the point, and it's accessible. I thought it was just a fantastic book and an absolute example of how history should be presented to the general public. So that inspired me to read more about Jack the Ripper, and I wanted to do my own book on the subject. I'd written a couple of other books. I've done some research for Ripperologist and some other non-fiction publications, as well as writing fiction. So it was a question of what book could I write? And originally I wanted to pick the top suspects and write about them, but then I thought that's been done before. They've had individual biographies, some of them. They've had a lot of other people writing secondary works about them. And then the idea came up to actually look at everybody who's been suspected at any one point in time, put them all into one book and say, okay, guys, here's the evidence against this person. What do you think? And it snowballed from there, and eventually I got 333 suspects who've been accused for
different... That's right, 333.
And actually, that's not all of them. There are some that were missed out for various reasons. And if you count all the people who confessed to being Jack the Ripper at different times in different parts of the world, the number's probably about 500. Which is quite amazing, really. And it just shows the fascination with the case. The people who accuse themselves are an interesting psychological study. It wasn't unique to Jack the Ripper. You have other big crimes that get a lot of publicity and people come forward and put their hands up without any reason, prompted by mental illness or by an addiction to alcohol or just an attention seeker in some cases. So yeah. I find that really interesting that people would do that, particularly in the Victorian period in England where murder obviously was a capital crime, and so people would risk their own necks for their moments of fame. And that was a very interesting thing to look at. With hindsight, I might have excluded some of those from the book, though, because I think that, are they really suspects? If the only person who accused them was themselves, should we now look back and say they're someone who could have been Jack the Ripper? There were a few that the police did look at, particularly in the earlier days. There was a guy called Blanchard who confessed in a pub in Birmingham. And the police went and looked at his background and checked out his alibi and all that sort of stuff. But gradually the sheer numbers meant it was impossible to keep on doing that.
Well, what...
sorry, go on.
Well, Paul, what I was going to talk about is, with your book, why I'm excited about it, being like a specific suspect ripperologist. But we just had Paul Begg on the show, and the very similar reasons why I love Paul Begg's book A to Z is why I like yours, is because it's actually a book that is first to be read before, if someone new comes into the business or is interested in the subject and you want to know anything about Jack the Ripper. Paul Begg's book is awesome, but yes. Also yours. And it's also, if you're curious about the suspects. And why I say that is because when I started reading, I was curious about how you presented your suspects. But what I first found very interesting is your chapter on the victims, the murders. That was impressive. And I thought a person that has never read anything about Jack the Ripper would get quite a bit out of it, and it was very factual. And that was the other thing was, I was amazed at how much evidence it was. It was evidence-based through these suspects. Did you do that on purpose?
Yes, absolutely. I didn't say it's a book to put my own opinions forward. I wanted to put the evidence out there so that people can judge for themselves. Because I think there's a lot of books which perhaps go down the path of promoting one suspect and they exclude facts that don't support that argument.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a trained historian, that's not the way we should present evidence. Yes, by all means, have an argument based on the facts, but you can't just discount something that doesn't fit your argument. You have to at least mention it. You right. might say that you're going to, that you don't know how it fits in with what you're trying to say, or you might ignore it, but you have to say it is there. And I think a lot of people perhaps fall into that trap that they get a bit obsessed with their central argument that so-and-so is Jack the Ripper, therefore I will only put forward the evidence that supports that and leave everything else out. And, you know, I've read some very, very good books which also have very good summaries of the crimes themselves, but then they get to a point where they start talking about the individual suspect and suddenly they go away from the facts into the realms of rather pointless speculation. And I think it's very easy for someone to come along. As I did when I was a teenager, you know, I could read Stephen Knight's book and be totally convinced by it as a newcomer to the mystery.
Right.
And the same for other books as well. Melvin Harris, you can pick that up and read it and think, yes, that's true. It's got to be right.
Yes.
But then you read something else which totally contradicts it. I wanted to say, okay, here is the evidence against all the suspects. Bearing in mind that most people are interested in the crime and the mystery because they don't know who the killer was. They want to identify him or possibly her, being right, controversial right. there. And so let's give them the evidence so they can go away and start to form their own conclusions. And then when they look at the more detailed studies of the individual suspects, they've got a bit of background knowledge so they can compare it against something. They've got that benchmark to say, actually, that doesn't quite ring true because this suspect did this. And so what this author is telling me may not be factually correct.
Right, right. And then especially with, and it was interesting because Paul Begg, not only does he, has he written that, but he's the book reviewer for us, for anyone that writes books. And what Paul did is his book review of yours was great. So that really, for us, you know, reading this is quite important to do that. The other thing was interesting to me is, while there's 333 suspects, and even more you're saying,
yes.
One of the questions I always get was, well, if there's so many suspects, then, you know, how can you be right or how can they be wrong? But one of the things is there's the fallacy of false equivalency that this particular suspect was taken seriously by Scotland Yard, like this one or such and such. But you did a good job, I thought, in kind of separating that. You put in, I mean, where there was, let's say, the particular suspects that Scotland Yard was looking at, you focused on that as well. So I was pretty impressed with that.
Yeah, I tried to divide it into a narrative showing the reasons why people were suspected, and that then follows into suit. So you've got all the murderers, people who did all murders branded together. You've got the contemporary suspects branded together. And I thought that was quite important as well, to try and isolate them so that you can sort of see in which categories the more serious suspects stand out.
Right, right. So, and the other thing is with Paul Begg, with his book, is it's basically going to continue, and there's always going to be new information built upon. And it seems to me that you have it set up that way as well, because there are researchers finding more and more information and have adapted it so you can each, you like revision one, revision two in the next few years.
Yes, I've started on a second edition already. If I find some new stuff out, I'm putting it back in and making changes. Because I think it's a living document. I think that there is so much research going on, you're absolutely right, and so much more is being found out, even about the minor suspects, which is a very interesting development in Ripperology, that people are perhaps going to look at that second tier of suspects and find out more about them. Francis Thompson probably being a good example of that, where, you know, probably 20, 30 years ago, no one would even have thought that he might be connected, and suddenly we've got information that suggests he could have been a suspect.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of information coming out. The hard part is perhaps staying on top of it. very, very difficult to be aware of everything. And yes, that's the difficulty at the moment, is trying to say, okay, this new book's come out, let's go and read it, let's go and find out what information is in there, what needs to be added to my book. Right. So yeah, that's a challenge.
Well, interesting. With in case of the suspect, I do. When we found that 900 pages of sworn testimony on Tumbledeen, the last 20 years of his life, yes, it was appropriate. You had the opportunity to get some of that in your book, and that there was even more. And so, just like you said, that I think you'll be interested in some more tidbits of information in the future for the next one too, just to augment what you've written already.
Absolutely. I think Tom Blecci is one of the stronger suspects, and the more we find out about him, the more I personally am inclined to favour his candidacy, as it were, because I think he's certainly up there as someone who could commit these crimes.
Right. And then, but still, though, what I like your approach, and I actually try this myself, even though I focus on him, I always try to say that it's not a case closed issue. There's some excellent candidates besides him, and so, but there's just new information. It just keeps on coming.
Yeah, and it's a question of evaluating that, because as it stands at the moment, I don't think we've got enough evidence for any of the candidates that would convict them in front of a jury.
Right.
I think we're a long way off that, because you look at the top suspects and you say, if that went to court today, what would a defence attorney make of it?
Yeah, right.
And you can say that all those cases would be thrown out, in my opinion. But what I want to do is to help the reader make some of those judgments themselves. So I set up some questions, as it were, to say, OK, here is a suspect. Could he have been the Ripper, first of all, in the sense of, are they actually a real person? Because some of them aren't. You know, Dr. Stanley, who Leonard Matters put forward, the Russian midwife, people like that, probably didn't actually ever exist. So you can discount those fairly quickly. Then you can discount those who had a documented alibi for whatever reason, which was noted at the time or discovered by research afterwards. Then you start looking at the reasons why they were suspected, and is there a valid reason? And if there is there any evidence against them? And if there's evidence, how strong is that evidence? Is it sufficient to warrant further inquiries? So I guess you're playing detective in a way. You're sort of going through and saying, if you were investigating this as a detective or a member of the police force, who would be the people that you would concentrate on? Who would be the top suspects that you'd want to find out more about and you want to question and take forward?
Right. What you were talking about, you said that in the 1980s you started getting interested in this, and how coincidental that 1988 was the 100-year anniversary of these atrocious murders. But you said about the royal conspiracy theories that you were kind of interested. Did you talk about those or expound about those?
In the book, yes, I mentioned those in terms of the suspects that have come out of it. And, of course, the royal conspiracy has developed considerably since it was first alleged. Personally, I don't put much credence to it, but I think there was some very good research. I think Stephen Knight, despite the problems with his theory, I think he's a very, very good researcher, and it's certainly a very readable book that he put forward, and it asked a lot of questions. But then others, of course, have built on that to various degrees, and it got to the rather absurd point where basically anyone who was in the aristocracy at the time or connected to it suddenly gets brought into the conspiracy. And probably the most recent extension of that is Bruce Robinson's They All Love Jack, which, whilst he says that he doesn't favour the royal conspiracy, he does favour a Masonic conspiracy going off in different directions. But that, again, was a very interesting book because of the length of research. I think it's been about 15 years putting the information together. And like Knight, I don't agree with his conclusions, but I do appreciate the effort that went into it, and he does make some very, very good points.
Right, right. It certainly does. So one interesting thing I have on a casebook there, you know, when you had the 333 suspects, but upwards of 500.
Yes.
When I wanted to tell you this, that there was a friend of mine that they his grandmother in an old suitcase found this photograph of this artist that had a picture, and the picture said it said Mr. J. McDermott. It said Mr. J. McDermott, the supposed Jack the Ripper. So yes. then what happened was is Chris Scott helped me out and found out it was Big Red Jim McDermott, who was a British agent. Yes. And then did you happen to write on that?
I did, yes. I actually mentioned that I saw the Facebook post and I included him in a fascinating character. And it'd be interesting to know how that came about, that connection, whether there was actually anything substantial, because I couldn't find any reason to think he might be Jack Ripper. But certainly he was in there. And quite a few other political figures as well. Jim Connell, the guy who wrote The Red Flag, which is the anthem of the Labour Party here, he was actually interviewed by the police at the time because he was out walking with a girl and he said something that she found offensive and gave him into custody. So there are quite a few people who've come to fame later on. There was a piece on the Jack Ripper Forum yesterday about Sir George Arthur, the British aristocrat, which of course you've mentioned before yourself,
right.
And about how he was arrested. And it was in the American media, but not the British press. But one of the points I made in the book was that there was a guy called George Compton who was arrested around the same time, actually arrested twice by the police and let go. Now, Sir George Arthur's second name was Compton. And so my theory is that this was actually the same person, that that was the name that either he gave to the police or that the police used to give to the media, so the aristocrat wouldn't be you wouldn't face the bad publicity.
Well, what's interesting is the New York World London correspondent who broke that story, his name was E. Tracy Greaves.
Yes.
And in October, he said that he had a Scotland Yard informant. So that kind of fits with what you're talking about. So I'd be curious to find even more about that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because a lot of information that we don't actually know. It's a bit like Matt Norton's private information about Montagu Druitt.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? We can't really evaluate it at this stage. Because all we can say is that someone suspected him because someone told them something.
Yeah.
But we don't know who it was or what they actually said. And I know there's a lot of research going into Druitt at the moment and into those connections. So it'll be interesting to see if that does come out. But at this point in time, it's probably difficult to actually identify precisely what was said. Bearing in mind, it's probably going to be verbal rather than written.
Well, you should be listening to our show in the future because Al has collected Jonathan Haynesworth in the near future. We're going to be talking about that.
Oh, fantastic. I will look forward to that because I do like his work. And I do like Druitt as a person to study. I think he's a fascinating character. But I'm just, at the moment, I'm not seeing that Jack the Ripper connection beyond McNaughton's comments.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting to see if anything does come to light there.
Yeah, and Martin Fido, I had said the same exact thing. He said, you know, we just don't know what he had, and he was so confident in it. So it's like he must have had something, but who knows?
Yeah, and it's interesting about McNaughton when he retired. The various pieces in the newspapers praised his memory, and I'm reading the memorandum. And I'm thinking actually. This doesn't really fit with what happened as far as we know. So it's interesting that his contemporaries regard him as having a great memory.
Right. Yeah. And how about with respect to the Polish Jew theory with Assistant Commissioner Anderson and about that? What's your take on that?
I'm obviously very interested in Kosminski, as I think most people are, but we can't reconcile the guy who went to the asylum with Jack Ripper. That's the basic problem.
Right.
And then the whole identification is very, very suspect. It's certainly not standard police procedure. You know, why would he be taken to a seaside home? Where is the seaside home? Who was the witness? And if the witness refused to testify because he was also Jewish, then that identification surely wouldn't stand up. And if they knew that was going to be the case, why did they even attempt the identification? Mm-hmm. So I find that very interesting. Now, I actually used to live in Hove in Clarendon Villas. In the early part of this century, I spent about 18 months in an apartment in Clarendon Villas. So I walked down there quite a few times around where the seaside home. So that was an interesting personal connection there. But I just can't understand why the police would take a suspect to the seaside home for identification.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Why would not be recorded properly? You know, because we're relying basically on Swanson's notes. Right. That's the only record of that. And I find that very, very strange. I did wonder if there was another Kosminski hiding around somewhere that we haven't yet picked up, but Martin Fader went through the archives of the asylums in a lot of detail. I think he's published his notes on the forum, or did before he passed away, and other people have gone through them too. And it'll be hard to think that there will be a different name used, because if Swanson knew the name as Kosminski, why would a different name be on the other records?
Right.
So again, it's questions that we have, but we can't answer. We don't know enough about the identification to understand why Kosminski was put in the frame.
Right, it's kind of like what Chief Inspector Littlechild said, that Anderson only thought he knew.
Yes.
Then, but it's interesting how Tracy Eanson, she's bringing up Jacob Levy and the possibility that the witness, eyewitness Joseph Levy, may be connected. So then the suggestion is that seaside home, it was the Levys that were involved with that. But then again, just like you said before, it's not Kosminski.
No, it's not. And I don't really buy the theory that Kosminski and Cohen were somehow confused and Kosminski was also originally in the fray. I don't think the police could really do that. I think if they had identified someone, they'd have a record somewhere, and that the top brass would certainly know it as a fact. I mean, Anderson said it was a fact, but that wasn't really shared with everybody. And, yeah, I find that very, very strange. And I very much want to look more into the Levy theory. That came a bit too late to be included in this book. But he's one of the suspects who sits just outside that top 10 currently. But I have a feeling that he will be pushed forward once I look at that information in more detail.
And I think her book is coming out soon, too, and she's promising some interesting information.
Yes.
So I think you're right. So
yeah, I think so. Because I started off with the... When you look at the evidence relating to the victims and the crimes, and you start saying, okay, what sort of a person was Jack? What do you actually know about him? And so obviously you know when he was operating, when the dates of the crimes, etc., depending which crimes you include and which you exclude. So you know he was in Whitechapel at that time. You know he was extremely violent. Even by the standards of the time, these were unprecedented in terms of the level of ferocity and mutilations, etc. And you can infer, I think, that he was a local person, that he knew the local area. I think that's a reasonable inference to make based on the locations of the crimes and the timings of them. I mean, yes, it's possible someone could have hung around to the train started and hopped on a train and gone off somewhere else, but I find that very, very hard to believe that they could have avoided suspicion at that time, especially given the number of police on the streets who were stopping anyone who looked a little bit odd. There's evidence of that. So it suggests he had some kind of bolt hole or somewhere to stay in the area and knew it quite well. And so, you know, so who fits that criteria? Who's an extremely violent local man who was free at that time?
Yeah.
And possibly Levy is one of them.
Right. And I remember, and McNaughton made a comment once that he said that there were just, I don't know, thousands of maniacs out there. So he had to, you know, it's which one that they were looking at. So looks like, and also the question of the syphilis. And I think Levy is one that is possibly having that as well.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it then comes down to motive. And obviously that's a difficult thing to talk about because we don't know the level of mental illness. And we don't know if the killer was deliberately targeting middle-aged women on the streets because he disliked that group of people, or if it was just an easy target because of his own health or strength. But certainly someone who had a reason to dislike prostitutes would be a strong suspect. One of the people I spoke about briefly, though I think he's discounted as a suspect now because he was in jail for the start of the early murders, was William Onion, who was accused in a letter to the City of London Police, basically saying this guy wrote the letter from Folkestone to Mr. McCarthy, and he was also the killer. And that letter was largely ignored, but when I looked into it, I found out that William Onion was one of the most violent people in London at the time. He had up to 1,000 convictions for drunkenness and violence, which I've documented separately, and I've got a biography about him, which I hope to get out there soon.
Oh, great.
But... To me, for a long time, I thought he fitted the criteria. He was extremely violent, a local man. He also attacked his wife with a knife on the wedding day after finding out that she was taking money from a gentleman, which obviously implies that she had money from an immoral source, and that would give him a motive to attack middle-aged prostitutes, given that his wife was in that category at the time. But when I looked at him in a lot more detail, it became clear that he was in jail for the early murders at least, because he was sent down for 12 months in November 1887. The prison records don't reveal when he was released, but it would be very, very unlikely that he was out on the streets in August. I think it's, you know, we can't assume that would have happened. And also when I've looked at him in a lot more detail, he doesn't seem to have the right characteristics, in my view. Looking at what he did subsequently, he actually repented in his 60s and became a famous street poet and discovered religion and started preaching against alcoholism. And I think that when he made that conversion, I think if he had this terrible secret, I think he would have unburdened it, given that he spoke quite candidly about the rest of his offences. But certainly he was an interesting character who came out of this. And I think out of the 333, they've all got interesting and fascinating stories.
Right. The other thing with that, and when you talked about the victims, what I also liked about it, usually I see, and this is what I actually did myself, was focus more on the canonical five, the exception of the previous ones. But what I liked about what you did is you actually went into the post-Kelly murders, I think you even went at Rose Milette with December 20th, 1888, and then Alice McKenzie, July 17th, 1889, and then Francis Coles to 1891. And it was nice because then you were comparing and allowing the reader to see the similarities and differences. So that's what impressed me about that part.
Yeah, well, those cases came from the police files, so those are the ones that were linked at the time for whatever reason. Some of them have faced themselves, so they shouldn't have been. Those were the ones that they sort of branded together at the time. So I think that they were probably the ones we should concentrate on. Although there has been a lot of research lately into the Thames torso murders and the suggestion that quite a few people seem to be pushing that they were connected in some way. Which is interesting. I don't know enough about them myself at this stage to really comment on that, but I think it's certainly something worth looking at because if the same person was responsible, and that's a lot of murders to attribute to him.
Right. Yeah. And then when you're looking at the ideas of MO versus offender signature, the offender signature seems to be a little bit different on that. In my opinion, but then again, I'm just my opinion.
Yes, I think so. I think there are differences in there, but we can't assume that the person would have had the same MO and that a signature would also develop over time. And I think when we've looked at other killers, we've seen they might have started off with one particular crime, and as they've got more confident, they've changed their procedures and they've done things slightly differently in each case. So I didn't want to go down to say Edson Castor be exactly the same. I think certainly when you look at the Stride and Eddowes murders, there was a different knife involved. That's pretty clear. So you have to have the scenario either the killer carried two knives around with him, or he had the opportunity to discard one and go back and get another one for somewhere else, or it was different killers.
Right. And then the surgical knives, let's say a kit, and then but then there was slightly different. What you made a point about is that the surgical knives were slightly different than, let's say, knives for postmortem or amputation.
Yes.
And so that is kind of an interesting point that you made. Another question would be for the listener is, with all of this, how about the police? Did they what was your take on why it seems like they were lost, or what's your take on that?
I don't think they're necessarily lost. I think they haven't dealt with anything like this before. And in those days, of course, there was no forensics, and they relied very much on information being received and people being seen in the vicinity. Yeah. So I think they did probably what the right thing to do was just to get lots of police on the streets, stop anyone who looked a bit suspicious. So I wouldn't necessarily criticise their investigation. I think you can perhaps look at the top and say it might not have been directed very well with Anderson being off for a while and with Sir Charles Warren perhaps not getting to grips with it and being able to direct it properly. But it was unprecedented, you know, and I think we shouldn't assume that there was a deliberate intention to get things wrong or to let people get away or to hide anything. I think they actually did their best in the circumstances, and certainly you can see the number of people who were stopped and questioned and the amount of evidence that survived suggests that they were very thorough in trying to solve the crime.
And speaking of that, especially with Commissioner Warren, the politics involved, that probably, especially when you had Scotland Yard or the Metropolitan Police involved, but also the City of London Police.
Yes.
Did you comment about that, or what do you think about that?
I think it causes problems when you've got different jurisdictions because it means you haven't necessarily got an overview of the whole investigation. But that's not unique to Jack the Ripper. It was the same with the Yorkshire Ripper in England, where you had lots of different forces looking at information, not perhaps sharing that data.
Right.
I mean, if you look at William Onion, for instance, the letter went to the city police, who didn't do anything with it. If it had gone to the Met police, who knew him very well through his regular appearances in the police courts, they might have taken it more seriously and said, hang on here, this guy's worth looking at. But that sort of thing. So I think perhaps that if there was a fault with the police, it is that overall strategy and direction, because basically they were just trying to flood the streets with officers and they were trying to stop anyone who looked a bit suspicious. And you know, that could have worked. They could have got lucky and they could have stopped the Ripper through those tactics. But as far as we know, they didn't.
I recall reading Commissioner Waring making a comment that he did not really believe that CID or the investigative division was going to find the offender, but was going to be one of the police constables happening upon them. So I think in October he doubled the patrols.
Yeah, and I think that was a sensible thing to do, because the Ripper almost certainly didn't have a group of contacts who knew what he was doing. Looks like he was operating on his own. Yes, he may have had people at home who might have been suspicious about his behaviour, about him being out at night, etc. But if he was someone who had a place of his own or who slept on the street, they're not going to have someone who's going to go and talk to the police about that. And in the Jewish community as well, the chances of people coming forward and telling the police, yes, Jack Ripper is hiding in our community, I think were quite remote. I think the people were obviously scared of the reprisals, particularly the climate at the time. So I think it would be very, very brave for any of them to come forward and say, look, here he is. We've got him.
Right.
And I do believe that if he was in that community, that they would have tried to stop the crimes themselves and tried to conceal him as best as they could.
All right. And some conspiracies are like that, I think, that's been brought.
Yeah, so. I think the conspiracies tend to be at the higher level that the police and the Masons and the royal family all conspired to hide the Ripper. I don't think that's likely, because when you look at those suspects in that top edge of society, there's not really any of them that could have been walking around Whitechapel, not least because they would have been seen and recognised. And one of the things about the suspect that George Hutchinson apparently saw with Mary Kelly was the appearance, that they were very aristocratic, and you think in a rough area that's already in a state of panic, someone like that would stand out, not just a target for thieves, but also people would spot them and would report them. I'm pretty sure that would have happened.
Right.
Sir George Arthur walking around, the indications are from if he was George Compton, that he certainly had dressed down for the occasion. He wasn't, his top hat and breeches.
Well, they said that he was wearing a slouch hat.
Yes.
So he was dressing down, and apparently, that's when they were slumming it. And even Francis Tumbley said that he dressed down for the occasion as well when he went through there. You're right.
And I think that's sensible. Even today, if you go into an area that has a bad reputation, you probably wouldn't wear your best clothes or drive your best car and deliberately stand out. You don't want to blend in. Which supports the idea that the Ripper was someone who naturally blended into the surroundings, that he was someone who people knew and just took for granted.
Right. And then the positioning of the bodies, I know there's some conspiracies on the a pentagram and things. And in my opinion, it looks like it's just that one of the unfortunates took them off the streets, those two main thoroughfares. Did you discuss that at all?
Not in any great detail. I've mentioned the black magic theory, and you can look at some of the books. I think the Parlors did a pentagram in the book, and I think it was also done in a different book as well. But to me, it doesn't match. I think it's hard to say the locations are just coincidence, because we don't know if the suspect had any connection with those areas. It's possible they did. I think the fact that Keeley and Tongue had warehouses around some of the sites is quite interesting, particularly in view of the cutbush theory.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also likely that they were just quiet places where he could do what he wanted to do. And of course, Mary Kelly was killed indoors, which gave him more time to exercise a whole bunch of mutilations on her. And you kind of like think, does that argue against the Ripper not having a place of his own where he could do this sort of stuff? Was he someone who was on the streets or in a shared accommodation? Right. Because if he had a quiet place at home or some village, would he not have tried to take the victims back there?
Right, right. And how about the, you know, after Catherine Eddowes was murdered, then in Goulston Street they found a piece of Catherine Eddowes' apron, I think, and then there's the writing on the wall. What was your take on that?
I'm not sold on the theory that it was written by the killer, because the apron could have been left there at random, and we know there was lots of graffiti in the area. The key thing is trying to date when it came from, because obviously you had the police constable who passed through earlier and said the graffiti wasn't there.
Right.
So that suggests it was drawn in the middle of the night later, which would probably then tie it in when the apron was dropped. But it's also interesting that if that police officer was correct, then the Ripper went somewhere after committing the murder, then came back out onto the streets to deposit the apron there, as opposed to him running past and dropping it, which is possibly the most likely scenario, because if you go down the theory that he deliberately placed it, then you start to put a rationale behind his motives,
right.
And a plan. And if he has a plan, then you link that to the graffiti and you wonder what it actually meant. But we can't prove it lends it more than a coincidence. And I suspect the most likely scenario is that he dropped it when he was running past, which would obviously dictate where he went on that day, and that the officer walking past didn't see it.
Right, right. And that probably is appropriate, because you think if you're not looking for something, you're just walking by, and then you would not like pick that up, and I can just see as well that at that moment the offender is trying to get out of the area as fast as he can.
Yes, and you wonder why he took the apron with him. Was it because he wrapped the organs possibly in it? Maybe. That would possibly make sense, but then what did he do with the organs? So, you know, did he take it somewhere, dispose of them, and then go back out and dump it? Yes, it's an interesting discussion, but it's one of those things that we can't really prove. I think it would be nice to think that the graffiti was written by the killer, but I don't think we can necessarily say that as a fact.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why I'm talking about it is because how you approach it in your book is that you leave it open for people to...
Yes.
Just like you're speaking as well, you're leaving it open to allow people to know that it happened, but it's something that we have to look at and discuss. So,
yes.
Al, I'm sorry. Did you want to ask a question?
No, things are good. I just want to know, the thing from a person that doesn't research this sort of thing, I would think... A lot of times when I'm reading or listening to these books on Jack the Ripper, I don't hear enough about the type of lifestyle people in that part of London lived. There needs to be a little bit more about that, so people understand what it was like to be in London in 1888.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because when we talk about the police investigation, people might think that, you know, they had all the detective methodologies that we have available today in forensics, when actually they didn't. It was predominantly a very poor area, very, very rough. But there is also evidence that some of the people living there were decent working class families who weren't involved in crime, and were trying to avoid those who were. A lot of alcoholism, which is sad. Quite a lot of homelessness as well, which again would contribute towards the situation that you have all these people who are sleeping on the streets. Then it's going to be very hard for the police to stop them all and and take them in. And quite often they might have just left people who were lying on the ground sleeping and apparently not causing any problems. So I think you're right. I think it is. Some writers have looked at the social economic conditions, but I don't think it's been a really, really good book that has explored that in the context of the murders.
Yeah, I think it's hard to understand the context because of that. I mean, people apply their life today,
yes,
you know, they might think, well, you know, a bad area or a poor area, but they're thinking of today. I mean, the police actually washed down the crime scenes, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, big difference.
Yeah,
big
difference. And you know, the bodies were, there wasn't a proper mortuary at the beginning, so the bodies were taken away on a cart.
Yeah.
and not, you know, so you think that from today, forensics will be horrified because so much evidence has actually been lost there. And a lot of the scenes weren't properly documented, which again causes problems later on. The writing on the wall, for instance, the fact that was washed away, that was, you know, you can argue it both ways, that it was a massive misjudgment, or that the call was right to protect the local Jewish residents from any reprisals. But certainly that's a piece of evidence which was destroyed. And so much so when it came to the inquest that they couldn't agree on what the actual wording was, and the police constable had to go back and check his notebook again. So that was quite interesting. Things that today we'll take for granted just weren't done.
So, Paul, who was Jack the Ripper?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I think out of the suspects we know about, he's would be in those top 10 that I put forward, but it's equally possible that he was someone that we haven't heard about yet, and I suspect that's probably more likely.
I kind of figured it was Margaret Thatcher.
Well, it's,
but what do I?
It's interesting that some women were accused, though, and I did a chapter in a book on the women. And some of them are quite interesting characters in their own right, again, but I don't think there's much evidence to support the idea that it was a female doing these crimes.
Yeah.
Well, the female wasn't strong enough either, right, in those cases. Wasn't there something to do with strength? You had to be pretty strong to do it?
You did, but there were some strong women about then, so I wouldn't say that was an argument against it being a woman. I think it's more the fact that of the witnesses who did see something, it was always a man that they saw. None of them were seen with women coming up. If you take the Kelly murder, for instance, it was a man who went to a room. It was a man that Hutchinson saw her with. And you look at the evidence. So I don't think there's any evidence that it was a woman, but it's certainly an interesting theory. And the type of women coming forward, very much the midwife and convicted murderesses, were those who were put forward.
Well, maybe they identified as a woman.
Well, that's possible as well. It has been suggested as well that the killer wore women's clothing to escape, and that could possibly explain the sight of a Mrs. Maxwell, who allegedly saw Mary Kelly after she'd been killed and spoke to her. So that's quite interesting.
Wow. So now, do you yourself have a website and interact with people on that?
I do have a website, yes. I also have a Facebook writer's page, so you can find me at paulecwilliams.org, or if you go onto Facebook, you can find me as a writer under Paul E. C. Williams. So I can chat to people through there, and I also use Twitter as a means of communicating. But certainly any updates as to what I'm doing as a writer will be on my website for a blog, and that is linked to the Facebook writer's page.
Now you've got the Jack the Ripper Suspects book. What else have you written, just so people know?
Okay, well, I've done a lot of short fiction. I've also got a couple of non-fiction books. The first was called Howls of Imagination, and that was an abridged version of my PhD about the wolf in folklore. Particularly stories about the man-eating wolf and how they developed. Very similar to Jack the Ripper, actually, in the sense that you're looking at the facts of what actually happened and trying to understand how this myth has been constructed. And I've also written a book called The Mystery Animals of the British Isles, Gloucestershire and Worcestershire, which is an account of creatures that shouldn't be around but have been seen, so like big cats loose in the British countryside, that sort of thing. So again, looking at the evidence for them, what people have said they've seen, what the likely explanations are. So those are the three non-fiction books I've published so far. I've hopefully got the biography of William Onion coming out very soon. There's people interested in publishing that. And I'm working on a big book about Mary Jane Kelly as my next major project.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a long way up there.
You're a busy man.
I try to be. There's a lot of work involved.
Wow. That's fantastic. So now we will, of course, have your book up on our website as well and anything like that, so people can do one click if they're listening to the interview or when they listen to the interview. Any last words on Jack the Ripper and where we're going to go with it?
I think we will continue to do the research into the individual characters. I think that's certainly a trend that's happening now. So we're going away from that general overview of the case into, okay, here is one person that we suspect, and we're going to analyse his life in a lot of detail. And I welcome that. I think it throws a lot of light onto the period at the time, particularly when we start delving into that lower class of suspect, which goes back to Earl's point about understanding the conditions of the time. I think the more we can do that, the more we can unravel and start to understand what people thought at the time. And if, as is likely, the killer came from that lower class society, the more we can understand those groups and that community, the more likely we are to identify them at some point in the future.
Well, fantastic. Well, again, it's been an interesting conversation about Jack the Ripper. The book is Jack the Ripper Suspects. It's the definitive guide and encyclopedia. And the writer is our guest, Paul Williams. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for your time. It was appreciated.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.